from WJCT in Jacksonville, Florida. I'm Al Letson, and this is State of the Reunion. So today's show is a part of our special series around Black History Month. Typically, this time of year, we remember civil rights icons and reflect on their legacy. What those courageous men and women did was amazing, but the struggle continues. In my travels with State of the Reunion the last couple years, I've had the pleasure to meet what I think of as the next generation of African-American leaders. Now, you won't see a lot of these people on TV arguing with pundits or making speeches. Some of them may get national prominence, but most of these men and women are on the front lines rolling up their sleeves and putting in hard work for their community. And that can be very unglamorous work. A lot of times they go unnoticed because they don't fit the narrative around the civil rights struggle. There aren't many marches or sit-ins anymore, and the nature of the struggle has shifted, and so has its leadership. So on today's show, we have gathered some of my favorite stories and people from past episodes, African-American visionaries, leaders, people who are making a difference, people like Davon Love, who as a kid in Baltimore came really close to falling through the cracks.
I mean, in elementary school, I did okay. Middle school, you know, I kind of lagged behind, lost interest.
This isn't a shocking revelation. I mean, all over Baltimore, all over the country, school districts are struggling to find ways to keep young people engaged. And Davon was well on his way to falling through the cracks. Until one morning, when something put him on a completely different course.
It was cold outside. I was at school early. I wanted a reason to get in the building. So I told the people at the front, I'm coming for debate practice. You know,
debate practice. Davon's high school had a debate team, but as far as he was concerned, well, that wasn't him. Davon was one of the cool kids, and the debate team was, well, kind of nerdy.
I mean, I thought debate was like two podiums and people trying to sound good about whatever, and suits and ties, and trying to use a bigger word than the other person who spoke. That's what I thought it was.
Once inside, though, he was surprised by what he saw. Here was a group of kids, kids who looked like him, who acted like him, many of whom were known for speaking out in class and getting into trouble. But here, at debate practice, they were being encouraged to get up and speak their minds, to give their opinion on any number of topics. But the big difference was that they were actually being listened to.
I mean, one of the things that attracted me to debate was that it was student-centered. It kind of put students in the driver's seat. And so that was a unique thing for me, because I, you know, in school, it's all about the test and what the teacher wants, figuring out what the teacher wants and giving it to the teacher. You know, debate was one of those things where it really allows students to do some intellectual exploration that school didn't really facilitate very effectively for me.
What Davon stumbled upon that morning wasn't just specific to his high school. It's a part of a whole movement in Baltimore that was started more than 12 years ago.
People would say to us, Baltimore City kids are going to want to debate? Like, kids in our public schools? Are you kidding me? We're going to have to pay them.
That's Pam Block, who's the CEO of the Baltimore Urban Debate League, or Boodle for short. They took that skepticism on head-on and approached schools around the city. They offered to train teachers to be coaches, and they helped them identify prime recruits to be debaters. They weren't looking for the academically gifted and talented. They were looking for the misfits.
So we're really looking for kids who need debate for whatever reason, because they're behind in reading, because they're acting out in class, because they don't come to school often enough, because they're the kid that's always arguing with the teacher. Those are all the perfect students to recruit for debate.
I like to express my feelings and I love to talk, so.
Since I like arguing anyway.
That's what I'm known for. At least my best friend knows me for that. She's like, you're annoying. You always want to argue about something.
Those are some of the debaters at Frederick Douglass High School. We'll get back to them in a second, but first, how do you get them to try debating in the first place? Teenage kids, one word, pizza.
If you have pizza in a classroom after school, kids will come, and through the pizza, they start watching what other kids are doing and seeing that, oh, they think they're right about that. I don't agree with that. I could do that. All they're doing is arguing. I could do that. And so you kind of pull them in these, you know, sideways kinds of ways, and before they know it, they find themselves getting sucked in.
And like a comet getting caught in the gravitational pull of a star, it can change their whole trajectory in life. Boodle eases students into debate by giving them topics they already have an opinion about, say, school uniforms. And little by little, coaches show kids how to back up an argument with evidence, how to make their case.
What was shocking to me, though, as I got involved in the work, was how quickly somebody can change through this activity. It's almost overnight that a young person's perception of themselves and what they're capable of changes when they start to define themselves as a debater, because they suddenly feel smarter. They may not yet be actually any smarter, but they feel smarter.
There's no need for infrastructure, because anything that the government try to do, society itself is going to try to bring it down.
We're at Frederick Douglass High School for a practice debate with some of Boodle's newest recruits. The topic today is whether Baltimore City should invest in infrastructure.
Like, they spent $7 million. Like, every day money's being made. So why not just...
I think we should put money into it because it's already messed up. It needs to be fixed.
I disagree, because I think the federal government should be paying for this. If the federal government is paying for this...
Every few weeks, the Baltimore Urban Debate League takes over an entire school, with each classroom hosting a different debate. Now, the thing to remember here is that many of these kids might not have been on the college track without debate. A lot of these kids were just barely making it. But if they stick with it, they can go from sounding like those novice debaters to...
We don't claim that you know, all black people are oppressed as individuals. Our argument is that the institutions that create the type of oppression that exists cause...
That's Davon Love again, the debater who stumbled into practice that cold morning. This audio is from the National College Debate Championships several years ago. He became such a strong debater in high school that he got a scholarship to Towson University just outside Baltimore. And in 2008, with the confidence and knowledge he'd gained from debating, he and his partner began challenging the very structure of college debate, arguing during competition that the debate community needed to change stylistically and embrace black cultural aesthetics like hip-hop and spoken word poetry. And those arguments got them all the way to the championship finals. It was a pretty radical moment, and no one expected them to win.
In the round between the affirmative and Towson, Devin Cooper and Davon Love, and the negative, Nate Johnson and Chris Stone, the decision is a 7-4 for the affirmative.
After winning, Davon knew he couldn't leave debate behind once he graduated from college.
We figured we had all this training in public policy and structural analysis. We figured we should use that. I mean, because a lot of, like, lobbyists and politicians come out of policy debate, you know, and the communities that are able to have access to people with those skills are people who have money to pay them extraordinary amounts of money to do so. And we felt, you know, Baltimore needs people with that level of expertise.
These days, Davon teaches at a Baltimore charter school and coaches debate. Now, for all his wonky talk, he still wears Converse sneakers and t-shirts. He might have joined the nerds, but he is still a cool kid. The rest of his work is anything but casual. He's gathered together a group of former debaters, other 20-somethings like himself from Baltimore City. They call themselves Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, or LBS, after a Talib Kweli song.
We call ourselves a traveling community think tank. The idea is connecting young people to public policy.
And we're joined by 8th District candidate, Mr. Davon Love. How you doing, sir?
Doing pretty good.
Since LBS began a couple years ago, they helped Davon run for Baltimore City Council at the ripe old age of 24.
24 years old. Why would a 24-year-old want to run for city council? And why the 8th District and why now?
Well, first I want to thank you for giving me this opportunity, this platform. I think one of the things, you know, growing up is noticing that many of the conditions that exist in our communities affect young people in ways that are unique. And for me, it's really important not just to sit on the sidelines, but really get involved in many of the things that are going on. And so,
in addition to Davon's political campaign, LBS has mobilized people against the construction of a new juvenile detention center in Baltimore. They put out policy papers on education and housing. They've had exchanges with the CEO of Baltimore City Schools about trying to get some of their ideas implemented. They're dreaming big.
If we really put our minds to producing data and making arguments not for a game, but for real life, just the measure of success we've had in debate really gave, I think, all of us confidence that we really could do something that other people didn't think we could do.
I feel like a lot of people in Baltimore have an opinion, but they don't know exactly how to voice that. And I think that policy is definitely a tool in which you can make change in the city.
It's not the sexy part of politics. Like, we don't get to be the folks marching and, like, screaming and yelling and being the protesters. We got to be the thinkers that get people mobilized.
10 years from now, are you guys the Brookings Institute Heritage Foundation? Are you what's the game plan? 10, 20 years?
Probably gonna be that, but black, you know.
We actually just got registered as a political action committee, so we actually have a formal political action committee associated with the organization.
Now, Davon didn't win his campaign for city council, but that didn't deter him, nor the members of LBS. It's just a bump in the road, part of the journey that started on a cold Baltimore morning that led him to the debate team, which led him to college, which led him to co-found a think tank with its eye on the future.
I think long-term, the effect that we're going to have is being able to demonstrate to Baltimoreans how to manifest power. Because I think that's something that's very important and that we're lacking, is to, you know, how do we organize effectively to have power?
All this hour, we'll be telling stories of people like Davon, leaders from unlikely places and unlikely backgrounds.
You know, I started very young, man. I started, like, selling dope meters for a dollar when I was 10 years old.
That's coming up on the State of the Union. If you want to hear and see more of State of the Reunion, you can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/sotrue. That's S-O-T-R-U. We're on Facebook, iTunes, and of course, stateoftheReunion.com. Support for NPR comes from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org, the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of edutopia.org, a source for inspiration and information about what works in education, and the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. This is NPR.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Natural Gourmet, Champagne, Roland Realty, Champagne, and Strategic Farm Marketing, Champagne. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
Welcome back. You are listening to State of the Reunion. I'm Al Letson, and as a part of our series on Black History Month, today we are telling stories of African-American leaders. But these people might not be the type of leaders you're thinking of. Take, for example, Mr. Leroy Jones in Miami, Florida.
You know, I started very young, man. I started, like, selling dope meters for a dollar when I was 10 years old. We used to buy them from the junkies that worked for Jackson Hospital. They would sell us a box. They called them works. You know, they would sell us a box of works with 100 in it for $100. We sold them for $2. We made a $100 profit off every box.
The beginning of Leroy's story is a classic tale of a young hustler learning the ways of the street. Raised in a ghetto, like many young black men he grew up with, Leroy dropped out of school, got addicted to drugs, and served time for several offenses. All signs pointed to Leroy becoming a casualty of the streets. Just another statistic. But this is not that story.
This one actually is the first government award I won. That's the Merit Award. That's the highest award anybody can receive in Miami-Dade County. So I'm the only black, only non-professional person, only convicted felon to ever win that award.
In fact, this whole wall is covered with awards that Leroy has won. There's so many plaques, I can't even see the wallpaper. So how did he go from selling dope to winning awards for Miami's rich and powerful? Well, that comes back to a moment he had when he was in prison for the third time and on the phone with his mother.
And she said, "You know this your third time in prison?" She said, "Leroy, man, obviously you're not a good criminal if you've been to prison three times." She said, you got so much, you know what? She said, "You got something all black boys should have, and that's common sense."
That business instinct that Leroy had back as a 10-year-old selling drugs on the street to mark up the product and make a hefty profit, well, he could use those skills for ill or for good. And so when he got out of prison, he went to work in a small grocery store his mother and sister owned.
And I changed the store completely around. And it went from 1,000 square feet to 4,000 square feet in 6 months. Now all of the small businesses in the neighborhood asked my mom and sister at the what they did to change the store, and they was telling them that I did it. So about 11 of them came to the store one Sunday to ask to meet me, and so they wanted me to help them with their store. So that's how this started.
It was casual at first. Leroy would close the store on Sundays, and neighborhood business owners would gather there, trading tips. Soon, a sort of informal local business organization was formed, with Leroy leading the way. He called it the Neighbor to Neighbor Association, or NANA. And then he got an idea. He and the other members would choose a local store that was struggling.
Like, the first one was L&M Grocery Store, and they would say the address to buy everything that the business sell and donate the goods to the people that live in public housing. So I convinced everybody to go in and spend at least $25. So the idea was to buy everything except for the tobacco and alcohol.
In essence, Leroy had created his own grassroots version of a grant-making program, giving small black-owned businesses a sudden cash infusion.
The first one we did, I think the business owner made, I want to say it was $17,000+ in one day, when they was only used to making like $500 and $600 a day. So we bought, I would say, 96% of the stuff that they sold in one day. And now they restock the store with fresh new goods instead of things that have been sitting on the shelves for a long time.
The buyouts got so successful and popular, they had to stop doing them because they were getting too big to manage. But this was the kind of activity that drew some attention. A local paper did a write-up about him, and one day, Leroy got a visit from a county commissioner asking him to think about being a channel for government grant-making. But even with the commissioner's connections, it took a while for Leroy to get people in city government to take him seriously.
Now, even the blacks didn't want to sit by me because I wore the t-shirts and the short pants and didn't speak their language and didn't have the ties and the suit. So they didn't want to be by me because I didn't make them look good.
When I met Leroy, he was dressed the same way as those first meetings, shorts, t-shirts, and a ball cap. He looked nothing like a power broker. He doesn't have the polish of a typical Miami businessman or politician. He's plain spoken, but there's an honesty that emanates from him that's refreshing. What you see is what you get. But maybe Leroy's greatest quality that the people couldn't see was his tenacity.
It took me a year, and I said to myself, there's no way this town at that time gonna have $5 billion budget, and I not get me none of that money.
This wasn't money that Leroy was going after for himself. What he was creating was a nonprofit that supported small business development. And the city went for it, giving him $100,000 to disperse in his first year. As unlikely as it may seem, Leroy became a bridge between Miami power brokers and small inner city businessmen and women. With a grant from NANA, a mom and pop business can do a whole range of things, from buying computers to buying inventory to fixing up their shop. People would come to Leroy for help who'd never even thought of applying for a government grant before.
My name is Arsene Omega. I'm at 541 Northwest 2nd Avenue, Miami. I do custom tailoring and retail. I have been here for about 32 years.
Several years ago, Mr. Omega had just bought the building his store is in, but it was in pretty bad shape. He'd run through his savings and was about to close up shop when Leroy came in and said NANA could help.
I didn't think that it was going to work. I said, man, I don't want to waste my time when he came, but it take me to many meetings. It pays at the end. It'll keep me be here for another, I don't know how long, but I'm still here. I have a lot of respect for him.
Since Leroy's nonprofit gave out its first grant in 1999, he says his organization has funneled nearly $20 million in government money to small mom-and-pop businesses like Mr. Omega's. Part of what keeps him going is that he still feels he has a debt to repay to his community here in Miami.
I wasn't a good kid, man. So I remember all the devastation that I inflict on this community, man. You know what I mean? By hustling and robbing and stealing cars and all that kind of stuff. So, and that's my way of giving back.
Before we move on to the next part of the show, we thought we should give you a heads up. In the next story, we talk explicitly about sex and sexual violence. So if you're listening with children, you might want to keep that in mind. The Bronx has come a long way since the 1980s, when it was hit hard at the beginning of the AIDS epidemic. But there are still some tough statistics attached to the place. Today, HIV infection rates are higher in the Bronx and in New York City as a whole than almost anywhere else in the U.S. Young, gay, black men are especially at risk. This is Jerome Avenue, and we're out on the street sweating, looking for any patch of shade with Ja Love Serrano, model, dancer, and HIV activist.
Jesus, Lord of mercy. It's a beautiful day in the neighborhood, and is it hot?
Ja Love is a youth peer educator. He's braving the heat to hand out condoms and information about HIV testing to other young people in the Bronx.
Yeah, they're definitely taking the condoms.
Ja Love is 24. He's an old pro at this. He's been doing it since he was a teenager. But the young woman with him, she asks us to call her Jalise. Well, it's her first day.
Can I just run through the sprinklers really fast? I'm going to die.
Go ahead.
Jalise hasn't talked to anyone yet, and she's so nervous she's having trouble catching her breath.
I'm trying to hyperventilate. It kind of, you know, makes people nervous.
Right. People are so shy and getting condoms. Mm-hmm. You know, that's why you always have to be the cool person, very smooth criminal about it.
For a lot of teenagers, AIDS seems like it happened a long time ago. But for Ja Love and Jalise, AIDS is a reality. They're both HIV positive. And they're part of a new generation of activists trying to stop the spread of HIV among young people in the Bronx, which involves just walking up to people and talking to them.
When you stop them, quick, straight to the point. Hi, how are you? My name is such and such. I work with Mater Free Medical Hospital. Uh-huh. Just want to give you some free condoms and lube, and also that we offer free HIV testing and counseling. All our information is there. Enjoy the rest of your day. Bam, bam, bam.
Okay.
Now, Ja Love can be nonchalant about what he's doing. Talking to Jalise, he acts like their work is as simple as handing out a flyer, but it's not. It's a matter of life and death. An issue that most people don't want to talk about, let alone have a conversation on the street. But for Ja Love, getting the information out there and mentoring younger teens is the only way anything's ever going to change. Because his own story could have turned out pretty differently if he'd been able to find out more about HIV as a teenager. Ja Love grew up in Hunts Point, one of the roughest neighborhoods in the Bronx. He knew he was gay from the time he was little. When he hit puberty, he started to have crushes and curiosity like any teenager. He saw straight kids at school dating, heard other people talk about sex, but he got no information at home. His mom couldn't accept his sexuality, and the word gay was barely even mentioned in his health class at school.
I was more than intimidated. I was more like, I don't even know how to start the conversation. Like, what do I say? I know I have these feelings. I don't want to be told that I'm wrong. Being that no one's going to tell me the right information, that's when I felt the need to gain the experience for myself.
All of Ja Love's friends seemed to be having sex. After the freshman year of high school, he did not want to come back a sophomore and still a virgin. He picked a guy he knew was interested. Ja Love was 15. It was the end of the summer.
First, it started out as consensual sex, but then turned into rape, because when I said no, he continued, and I had to have wait till he was done. After that, I was just like, okay. I stood for a little bit, and then I got myself out of there. And after that, I got really ill. I didn't know what was happening to me. It seemed like a bad flu. And that was a first indicator to me that something might have been wrong here.
He overheard a rumor the next week. The guy that he'd been with had stood up in front of his church and disclosed that he was HIV positive. Ja Love was scared. But before he could deal with the situation, a whole other reality slapped him in the face.
My mother kicked me out of her house for being gay and also not helping contributing towards bills. And so at 16, I was homeless in high school, but I couldn't focus on high school that time, so I also dropped out of high school.
He started staying with his aunt in the Bronx. She wanted him to help out with the bills, so he found a job at McDonald's an hour and a half away. A year went by, and he barely had time to see his friends. As Ja Love got more depressed, he found himself obsessing over his status.
I was always, like, thinking about it. Am I HIV positive? Am I HIV positive?
When he was 17, he went to a clinic to get tested, hoping and praying for good news. 2 weeks later, he forced himself to go get the results.
Everything started happening in slow motion. The nurse sat me down in the room, and the doctor came in. In slow motion, the door opened up in slow motion. She opened up my chart in slow motion. And when the words rolled out of her mouth, Mr. Serrano, you're HIV positive, it went through one ear, came out of another.
When he heard the diagnosis, he got out of there as fast as he could and tried to put it out of his mind. It'd be a while before he got up the courage to see a doctor again. But somehow, even as everything seemed to be going wrong in his own life, something was pushing Ja Love to get out there and help other gay teenagers. He started working as an HIV peer educator at Montefiore Hospital in the Bronx, and Ja Love was starting to feel like a leader, somebody that everybody knows.
And it felt good. I felt good giving out free condom packs, asking people to take a free HIV test. And I definitely was hitting the adolescent population, so we was hitting 13 to 24. And it really felt good, but at the same time, I felt like a hypocrite because here am I know my status, but I'm not even taking care of my status.
Ja Love eventually did go see a doctor, but he couldn't bring himself to go to regular appointments. He was too ashamed, afraid that somebody might see him going in and out of the clinic. He was convinced that he was going to die, estranged from his family. Ja Love felt lost, and that's when he met a woman named Tyra, and things finally started to turn around.
He was a bit bitter. He wanted the love from his family. He really wanted it bad, and he wasn't getting it. And so it made him bitter. Listen, I met this kid. He was like 16, 17 years old, drinking 4 or 5 Long Island iced teas a night, you know? So I knew that there was something wrong.
Tyra Alora Ross is an activist, a performer, a model, and a transgendered woman. She fled Trinidad Tobago as a teenager. Her own family never accepted that she's transgendered. She met Ja Love at a club. She saw him dance and recruited him to be one of her backup dancers. They bonded immediately.
It's just, you ever met anybody that just works? It just worked from day one. Like, I saw her, and I definitely met her at a point in my life where, you know, me and my mother relationship was never a relationship. It was just that she gave birth to me. But with Tyra, it's just like, I believe that's when I became alive, when I was born. Because it's like, I found my mommy, like, that's my mommy.
Those words just really touched me, and I, you know, felt like, whoa, this is really my kid. You know, I can't have kids biologically, but he's just one of my kids that have just made me feel like I am a mother and I have a child to live for and to protect.
Tyra works at the Bronx Pride Center and has been a mother to lots of young LGBT kids. It hasn't always been easy. She's lost 2 of her children to AIDS over the years. But she's assembled a sprawling family of siblings, cousins, aunts, and uncles. With Tyra in his life, Ja Love finally had someone backing him up, and he wanted to live.
So I went back into high school, I graduated high school, got myself into college, and I always wanted to pursue my modeling and dancing career. So I started pursuing that.
Ja Love turned 21. He toured the country as a dancer. It was the life he always wanted. Everything was going great, except one thing, his health. He'd still never gotten on daily medication, he'd been getting weaker, and when he finally went to see the doctor, they told him he had full-blown AIDS and cancer, Kaposi's sarcoma.
My spirits was really low. I was just like, AIDS and cancer, one of these things have to give. I can't go through both. There has to be one. I could deal with AIDS, but not cancer. Something about that word cancer.
For the first time, Ja Love seemed to realize that if he was going to reach everybody he wanted to help, especially younger gay teenagers, he would have to start taking care of himself. And the only way to do that was to accept his diagnosis.
I remember one day sitting in a hospital bed, and at that time, and I was like, again, I'm not religious, very spiritual. I was like, said a prayer. I was like, Lord, you see me through this, and I'm going to do your work. And after that prayer, I stood on my medication, and my immune system, she was shooting itself back up, and the cancer went in remission. And I was just like, oh, okay, I know what this is. I know what I got to do.
Since he's gotten healthy, Ja Love has pretty much become a 24/7 activist. And Tyra is so proud of him. She says that now that he's got nothing left to hide, he's pretty much unstoppable. Ja Love has worked as an HIV testing counselor and talks to high school kids about safe sex, not just in the classroom, also on the streets of the Bronx.
Well, that's a part of free también, so gracias para todo, and enjoy the rest of your day, okay?
Thank you.
No problem. Oh, my Spanish was really off right there, but we got a point across, and we gave our free condoms and gave them information.
To some of us, Ja Love's world may seem really foreign, growing up a gay teen in the big city, but is it really? Jalov's story could be mine. I mean, just like him, when I was a teenager, I was too young to understand the gravity of my decisions. At that age, you can make choices that affect you the rest of your life. The beauty of what Jalov has done is taking his personal tragedy and turning it into triumph. And not just for him, but for his whole community. Today on State of the Reunion, as a part of our Black History Month coverage, we are looking at the new African-American leadership that is coming up from the grassroots. Next up, a black sorority goes green.
When it really comes down to it, most of us are not willing to make the kind of sacrifices that have to be made in order to create a sustainable environment.
That's next on State of the Reunion. Support for State of the Reunion comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, a growing network of listeners, producers, and stations collaborating to make public radio more public. PRX.org.
WILL programming is made possible by Sinfonia da Camera, presenting From Russia with Love on Friday, February 14th at 7:30 p.m. in the Fullinger Great Hall at Krannert. Violinist Andres Cardenas joins Sinfonia and performs works by Prokofiev, Stravinsky, and Tchaikovsky.
You're listening to State of the Reunion, and today we are telling stories about African-American leaders. Our next one takes us to a building in Portland, Oregon. But this isn't just any old building. This place is almost stereotypically Portland. Green and sustainable, energy conserving, using local materials. I mean, you couldn't find a place in Portland that feels more Portlandish. Is that a word? Anyway, the ladies who created this space are not what you might imagine.
We are a sorority of service. We party, but we are here to serve.
Yeah, these ladies are sorority sisters from Delta Sigma Theta, a mostly African-American alumni chapter here in Portland. They're a mix of retired teachers, librarians, school counselors. The older members, they're kind of like badass grandmas. They're the kind of people who bake you cookies when you come to interview them. Yes, Chris Poole Jones did exactly that.
Enjoy the cookies.
I will.
Gluten-free, and I used cage-free eggs.
Sweet.
But good. I did use butter.
That's fine. I like butter. I'm with you. Can't cook without butter.
The story of how a bunch of black sorority sisters ended up with one of the greener buildings in Portland starts a couple decades ago. Gail Washington Johnson was the president of the sorority chapter at that time.
We had been meeting in libraries and in houses. And June Key, who was one of our wonderful, wonderful elder statespersons, really wanted something that was permanent for us to meet. And so she had been looking for about, over a year at different sites.
Gail says June Key came across this old shuttered gas station.
It had been abandoned at least a year.
Yes.
And it was very dirty.
It was trash to the top of the ceiling. To the top of the ceiling, yeah.
June offered the owner what she had, $2,000. And to their surprise, he said yes.
So it's yours.
And the surprises continued after the cleanup.
We did not know that we had those two lots over there also.
The gas station had been designated a brownfield by the EPA, which means it had been contaminated land. The Delta sorority sisters knew they wanted to do something special to transform it. Lila Roberts says they wanted to send a message to the African-American community in Portland.
And we, as a people, don't necessarily know a lot about sustainability. We recycle at home cans and bottles and papers, but when it really comes down to it, most of us in our regular everyday life are not willing to make the kind of sacrifices that have to be made in order to create a sustainable environment.
When they started looking around for an architect, they ended up getting hooked up with a Portlander named Mark Nye, who's interested in designing a building that met a super sustainable standard, something called a living building challenge.
The analogy is, you know, if you imagine like a bush or a plant that's a wild plant, the building has to basically do what that plant does. So it gets all of its resources on site, and it doesn't do anything. It doesn't export anything or much or bring anything on site. So it's pretty self-sufficient.
It's also very expensive. To pull something like this off, to raise several hundred thousand dollars, the ladies of Delta Sigma Theta had to be persistent and make a lot of personal sacrifices.
You're not going to Europe or going out and shopping, that kind of thing.
And then we had fundraisers, we had garage sales, we had what you name it, whatever. We raised over $200,000 within this own organization.
When we first looked at this project, I kind of had the same thought as you, as how are they going to get this project done?
That's Andrew Colas, an African-American contractor who was hired for the building. Now, part of the Delta's determination was that over 50% of the work on the project would be done by minorities, small businesses, and women. He says this project came down to sorority sisters like Chris Poole Jones, who volunteered her time as project manager, making it happen.
Chris is a very convincing person, so if she wants to have the building be living, it's going to be that way.
And as Chris shows us, proudly touring around the building, what they ended up with is pretty spectacular.
This is the coolest thing, because this is a kitchen. That's the kitchen cargo container. And then over here is the bathroom cargo container. And then
they've used recycled cargo containers as the structure for additions to the original gas station, which cost less than building from scratch. The windows were donated, as was the cabinetry. Native plants that surround the building help with water filtration. Geothermal energy heats the building, and soon solar panels will help power it. Sorority sister Leslie Ann Fink.
The floor is a recycled rubber, like rubber tires, and we chose the colors because, well, the black is nice and durable. The red is one of the colors of our sorority colors. So,
in fact, the June Key Delta Community Center, as they've called it, won a prestigious award from the EPA for transforming the building from a brownfield to an asset. The building feels like a physical manifestation of all the Delta's energy, as if they were able to make it happen through the force of their positivity. But the really significant thing is not the building itself, but what it represents in a rapidly gentrifying Portland. Contractor Andrew Colas says it's a different way of thinking about sustainability.
I think a lot of times we only highlight in Oregon the environmental side, but the Delta's embraced the social aspect of it.
As mostly white developers transform the neighborhood around them, he says this group of African-American women hired an African-American contractor for one of the greenest projects in the city.
So you'll see this neighborhood that I'm from, I went to school in, and you'll see all these other builders and contractors that don't look like a company like ours that are building in a neighborhood that I grew up in, and you don't see a company like me on them. So we talk about how sustainable Oregon is, how progressive it is, but a lot of times I think a lot of people miss that actual social element, and the Deltas nailed it. And I think that's the biggest feat and the biggest thing that should be celebrated, and that needs to be celebrated around the country.
You know, in life, it's really easy to stay in our own areas, the comfortable space we make for ourselves in our communities. You know, for example, you may go to work, drive the same route every day, see the same dilapidated area, and think nothing of it because, well, it's always been that way. But sometimes an outsider can look at the same place and see something totally different. Utica, New York, a town that has long seen itself as down and out, needed a new pair of eyes in one of its toughest neighborhoods, and that has made all the difference.
When I first came in this neighborhood, they were telling me, you're out of your mind. It cannot happen here. This place is totally barren. Nothing good can come out of this neighborhood.
Reverend Maria Skates was not born and raised in Utica, but like many other outsiders, she's been welcomed into the city. But the good Reverend isn't your normal resident who tries to settle in and just kind of go with the flow. No, Reverend Skates is a force of nature. Like the sun, You can't help but get caught in her gravitational pull. There's a certain steel that reinforces her presence that was forged in the fires of hardship.
I understand homelessness. I was homeless. I was out there on those streets in New York City and Harlem, and there I learned how to live.
From those early days living on the streets, Reverend Skates knew she wanted to give back, help people who were in the same predicament. She went to Bible school, did missionary work all around the world, and when she was in rural Russia, she was trying to decide where to go next. That's when she got a letter from a friend who lived just outside of Utica. And he mentioned that there was a Russian community here, but more than that, there were people in need of help. Reverend Skates prayed about it and decided, all right, Utica it is.
I began to ask everyone what was the worst area in the city of Utica. That's where we wanted to come. Everybody said Cornhill.
Now, Cornhill had once been the rich part of town, but by the 1950s, those folks moved to the suburbs. Absentee landlords took over, and within one generation, Cornhill became Utica's ghetto.
This whole block, all of it was just full of drug dealers, full of murder, trash, garbage, and debris.
But Reverend Skates is a woman of vision. And one day, she was getting a tour of the neighborhood, and she pulled down one street where all the houses were clustered around a small park, and she knew this was it. One building in particular was a burnt-out crack house, but that's not the kind of thing to dissuade Reverend Skates. She bought the house practically on the spot.
And from November 1995, I spent a couple of winters in here wearing coats, but positive change has come to our neighborhood.
And you've done it basically one house at a time.
We did it one house at a time. When we moved in here,
slowly, with the help of her partner in this venture, Reverend Meyer, they acquired the buildings in this part of Cornhill, gradually turning the neighborhood from slums into supportive housing, a place where women and children, former drug addicts, convicts, people who have no other place to go can live and get services. What were once crack houses are now an orderly complex of apartments. A food shelter is in one, housing for the chronically homeless are in several others. Reverend Skates has a vantage point on the whole neighborhood from her third floor apartment.
This was my favorite window here. So I go here and I go, hello, how you doing? We're having a good time today, aren't we? How y'all doing?
She has some unorthodox ways of going about restoring the neighborhood and the lives in it. Like the bullhorn announcements out of the window.
They never knew when we sleep, so they never knew when we were watching. And we were very proactive. I'll help you. But I hit the three P's. I'll pray for you. I'll preach to you. And if that don't work, I'll call the police on you. The three P's. And that's what we did.
Outside, residents are shoveling snow and ice. One of the many tasks people do to take care of their neighborhood. Reverend Meyer tells me the transformation of this area is a reflection of the work they're doing with individuals, working on change from the inside out. It's the kind of transformation she knows is possible from personal experience. You see, she herself used to be a drug addict.
So I was one of those so-called troublemakers. Was 2.5 years in rehab. So you can change that much. You can restore that much. There's a lot about restoration. You know, and as we were able to change the restoration, the houses, we believe the lives can be restored.
We met some of the people working on restoring their lives. One of them was Miss Fowler. Now, everyone here is Miss This or Mr. That, a mark of respect to each adult. Miss Fowler has carefully straightened chin-length hair and a bright green Johnson Park Center t-shirt. She moved to Utica with an abusive boyfriend. And after they broke up, she found herself slipping into an old drug addiction.
My house was a mess. I wasn't taking care of my kids. And at the time, they were 7 and 8. And they weren't going to school. And if they did go to school, they were wearing dirty clothes. As far as my government benefits, you know, all that went on the crack cocaine.
When Miss Fowler heard of the Johnson Park Center, she was at risk of losing custody of her kids.
Reverend Skates, like, her and Reverend Maya both, she's like, they're like the parents that I never had, you know, because my mother and father were both drug addicts. So from the beginning, you know, I was in foster homes until I went on my own when I had my first daughter at 14. So I know that I needed the structure. And the structure made me, it makes me a better person.
Johnson Park Center is filled with stories like this. And after witnessing all the work the two ladies have done in Cornhill, I was a little surprised to go into their apartment on the third floor of the house where all this started and see them living in poverty.
There is no running water, hot water in the kitchen sink. Our stove was leaking gas, so we had to have the stove taken out, and so we microwave cook now. The walls all cracked up, as you can see.
In order to help the rest of the neighborhood transform, Skates and Meyer have taken practically nothing for themselves. This hardship has gotten even more difficult as Reverend Skates became sick with pancreatitis and can't go up and down the stairs any longer. And that is when the community decided it was time she had a real home. A former hockey star and Utica native named Robert Ash heard about the work the Johnson Park Center had been doing, and then he heard how the two women behind it were living.
And he went out into the community and had raised money, volunteers, donations, contractors, and they were building a house from the ground. So he came to let me know, we do need you to sign the papers, and we're going to build you a house. Unbelievable.
We actually could look through the window of the new house, but couldn't go in because it's in the middle of construction. As Reverend Skates explained the layout, she was envisioning using much of the space to help others. But Reverend Meyer told us the community won't let that happen. This place is for the two of them. Time for them to have something they've given so many others. A home. In every episode of State of the Reunion, we ask residents to pen a letter to the place they call home. For this episode, we thought it was important to look at how a community leader sees the place that they fight so hard for. And Carol B. Bell's letter fits that description. Carol is the founder of Ashe Cultural Arts Center in the Central City neighborhood in New Orleans. And I love this letter. I think you will too.
My dear New Orleans, all my life, you have been my touchstone, the place where I fit in and belong. I know the cadence of your heartbeat, the rhythm of your streets. You have shown me life so sweet it brings joy to my heart, and life so hard it makes me cry. I have learned balance and how to keep it in the New Orleans equation that offers such a wonderful blend of culture, art, lifestyle, spirit, and just plain living. Mama Nola, you have shown the world the need to enjoy the fullest range of human experiences from birth to death. You help populate the human landscape with notice and ritual that reminds us of the true value of living. You are rising from a beat-down disaster that would have destroyed most and are singing away your blues, dancing up a storm of revival while you take leap after leap of faith that around a near corner, across an overpass, or up a familiar street, a new New Orleans waits for us all. We are becoming stronger, better and more hopeful as we see progress marching down streets like a Sunday second line. Wave after wave of folks are joining as the rhythm passes by, and the brass band's echo is calling the still away home. My dear New Orleans, I was born here, I live my life here, and this is where I will someday die. Add me to the long list of New Orleans believers, well-wishers, and mojo makers who are wanting, working, and willing you into a new era of New Orleans brilliance. Blessings and best wishes from your forever daughter, Carol.
You know, one of my core beliefs is that everything we know, every major truth or idea that we as humans carry, we learned from a story. Think about it. Everything. A story has the power to shape the world. But at times, we can get stuck in the narrative. We tell a story that's this way because that's the way we always tell it. But there comes a time when you have to expand the canon. It's good and right that we celebrate the struggle for civil rights and the leaders who helped bring our present into fruition. But we must never think that the fight is over. It's just changed. And the type of people that have developed into leaders, well, they've changed too. They may not fit into the boxes that the old narrative demands, but they are the visionaries, the roustabouts, the poet warriors that we are in desperate need of today. Because the future doesn't just happen. It's only what we make it. Leaders of the New was produced by Tina Antolini and Laura Starcheski, with help from senior editor Taki Telenidis. The rest of the So True staff is Delaney Hall and business manager Bree Burge. You can check us out at stateoftheunion.com or on Facebook, or also on Twitter at So True. So True is presented by WJCT and distributed by PRX and NPR, with major funding provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm Al Ledson, and remember, things fall apart. Our job, all of us, is to bring them back together.
WILL programming is made possible by the Illinois Pork Producers Association, presenting the 2014 Illinois Pork Expo, February 4th and 5th at the Peoria Civic Center, featuring educational seminars, trade show, and a special market outlook roundtable on February